This is Radio Times. I'm Marty Moscoen. In the 1950s and 60s, black families were often prevented from moving into white neighborhoods by the practice of redlining. Or if they did move in, it wasn't unusual for them to face threats and hostility from their white neighbors. It was a period of dislocation marked by white flight to the suburbs. Well, a group of people in the West Mount Airy section of Philadelphia decided to do something different, and it became one of the country's first intentionally integrated communities. Our guest Abigail Perkis grew up in West Mount Airy, lives there now, and has written a book called Making Good Neighbors about what it took to create a racially diverse neighborhood. She's a historian, assistant professor at Kane University in New Jersey, and she joins us here in our Philadelphia studios. And Abigail Perkis, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you. I'm excited to be here.
Happy to have you here. And joining us by telephone is Joan Kennedy Countryman. She grew up in West Mount Airy. In fact, moved with her family in 1951. She was the first African-American student to graduate from the Germantown Friends School. This was back in 1958. She became a teacher, went on to head the Lincoln School in Providence, Rhode Island, the Atlanta Girls School in Georgia, and interim head at Oprah Winfrey's Leadership Academy for Girls in South Africa. And Joan Kennedy Countryman, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
I'm delighted to be here. Thanks.
You're very welcome. Abby, let me begin with you. You grew up in West Mount Airy with your family, obviously, as a little girl. What are some of your early memories?
You know, I lived in Mount Airy from 1982 to 1989 and remember it being a really wonderful neighborhood. I had a lot of friends. I went to a community nursery school right in the neighborhood and had no real sense that Mount Airy was special until my friend's fifth birthday party, which was in August of 1986, and she was a biracial child. Her mother was white and her father was black, and ABC News came to the party to do a story on this integrated family, and it was just this really striking moment, even as a five-year-old, to know that race mattered, and that's one of my earliest memories from Mount Airy.
How about for you, Joan? What are some of your earliest memories?
Well, I moved to West Mount Airy from another section nearby, Germantown. I was 11 when I moved to West Mount Airy, and by that time I was the only student of color in my class at Germantown Friends School. I'd started there in third grade. So I was used to the idea that race mattered, but I was part of a family that believed that it was important to mix with other people and live comfortably. That's what community was about. So, my memories certainly in that time when I was in what we call middle school now, middle and high school, are mostly that when that race was a challenge, we had every right to stand up and do something about it.
Did your family, your parents, don't move there because it was an integrated neighborhood? Were they looking for that?
That's a really important question, Marty. I would say that my parents looked for a house. First of all, we're looking for a comfortable, pleasant, accommodating neighborhood and a house that they could afford that also was safe and pleasant to raise a family. So they weren't looking specifically for integration initially, although they certainly understood that was probably likely that the neighborhood would not be all black, since we were a black family. But they were comfortable with the idea that an integrated neighborhood was probably what we were going to find. And when we found it, by the time we moved to West Mount Airy, they had already had the experience of working with other people in the community to make sure that the neighborhood stayed integrated.
Let me go back to you, Abby, because one of the things that you write about in the book, and this is broadly speaking, is that for some of the white families, there was a certain sort of politics, even morality, about creating an integrated neighborhood, and probably a slightly different, I think we hear from Joan, for black families looking for something a little different than the white families were looking for.
Yeah, one of the things that came up time and again in the interviews that I did and also in the archival research was that for black families, there was certainly a sense of racial justice and wanting to play out this racial ideal, this ideal of democracy in the United States. But there was also these material conditions that came with integrated space, more reliable community services, safer schools, better real estate values, and that was really important for them in moving to the community, whereas for white families, part of the reason they wanted to integrate Mount Airy was to maintain the integrity of their neighborhood. They wanted to stay there, and they wanted to make sure that it stayed what it was. But they also saw it in some ways as performative. It was a way for them to live out the liberal ideal of integration.
Would that be true for your parents? Is that why they chose to live in Mount Airy?
You know, by the 80s, Mount Airy was a little bit different. My parents grew up in West Oak Lane, which is a neighborhood to the east of West Mount Airy, and they saw West Mount Airy as this racial ideal. And my grandparents, one set of parents decided to stay in West Mount Airy when it was turning over, or West Oak Lane, rather, and the other side moved to the suburbs. So my parents were a product of this racial system. They moved to Germantown, which is where they met, and then moved to West Mount Airy, and it was partly because of the politics there, but it was more the legacy of integration, more the tolerance that it had created by the 1980s. And it was also a sense of upward mobility from Germantown. The people in the 50s, I think, and 60s were more a product of that performance.
Joan, if I can go back to you, and I want to talk to both of you, but I mentioned in my introduction redlining, the practice of keeping African-American families out of certain neighborhoods. Was that something that your family experienced?
Oh, definitely. In fact, Marty, many years later, found a newspaper, the Evening Bulletin. I found the classified ad section. I found an advertisement for the house that my parents first bought in Germantown, that very address, and the last word in the ad was colored. And it was startling for me to see it as an adult, although I knew as a child that we had certainly bought a house on a street where there were white families and black families. So I was aware, even as a 4-5-year-old, that there was something special about where we were living.
You want to talk more about redlining, Abby?
Sure. Redlining historically started in the 1930s with the Federal Housing Administration, part of FDR's New Deal plan, and it became a way for banks and insurance agencies to define what type of homeowners insurance individual properties would own, or individual properties would get. So areas that were white, areas that were upper class, received high grades, and areas that had any minorities living in the neighborhood received lower markings.
So it was kind of a subtle, but maybe not so subtle way of controlling who moved where.
Very much so.
Using things like insurance. Who were some of the early, I guess, movers and shakers in West Mount Airy that said, you know, we're going to be different. We're going to create a different neighborhood.
You know, in the early 1950s, like 1953, 1954, there was a group of people from 4 religious institutions in the community: the Germantown Jewish Center, the Summit Presbyterian Church, and 2 other. I apologize.
That's okay.
I'm losing them right now. That came together and said, again, we want to create a space here. We want to maintain this as our community, and we want to figure out a way to do it differently from how these other places are doing it. We see white flight taking place all around us, and we want to figure out a different model. And so these religious institutions said, we have this authority in the community, and we're going to come together and look for another way of doing it. And they did extensive research from other places in the country and Philadelphia, around the world, to try to figure out what integration could look like and whether it was viable. And they came to the conclusion that it was viable and could even be conceived of as desirable.
But you needed these institutions, I guess.
Very much so. And the leaders of those institutions in particular. So Rabbi Elias Cherry, for example, was the head rabbi of Germantown Jewish Center, and he was instrumental in the creation of this integrated space. George Shermer, who moved to Philly in the mid-1950s, he had come from Detroit and worked in race relations there, and then became the head of the Human Relations Commission in Philadelphia. He and his family moved to West Mount Airy, and he was instrumental in taking it from sort of a grassroots, moral, let me talk to my neighbor and get them to talk to their neighbor. And he brought it to the city level and said, we need to create structural accountability and bridge this grassroots agenda with a more systemic process.
And Joan, were your parents actively involved in that?
Yes, they were. The Shermers were in and out of our house. We were in and out of theirs. Especially in the early days, both of my parents, Bill and Virginia Kennedy, were active in a number of community organizations that were exploring this and then supporting the idea that it needed to move to a systemic approach.
As you mentioned, or as I mentioned, Joan, you're the first African-American student to graduate from the Germantown Friends School. Now, did your parents, did they try the public schools and then ended up at Germantown?
Oh, yes. I started out in Emlyn School and went to there for kindergarten, first and second grade. My parents were increasingly unhappy with what I was experiencing. Actually, my story is that my best friend and I read ahead in the reader, and the teacher didn't know what to do with us, so she had us dusting the closets for a while, and we reported that to our parents. That didn't go over too well. The next thing I knew was that they took me out of Emlyn. My father, who was a public school teacher, talked at length to the principal and objected to this and was not satisfied with the response. So first I was moved to Logan Demonstration School, which was a much better school at the time, or at least for me.
Right.
But at the same time, he had a colleague who was a graduate of Germantown Friends and was teaching with him at Bach, and he urged my father to approach Germantown Friends. It turned out GFS was actually looking for families that would be willing to take the risk of enrolling their children and purposely integrating the school. So they volunteered me, and I went, and it was the whole experience was very positive for our family. It was, for me, obviously since I was the first, I think everybody worked very hard to make it work, and it certainly did.
Well, and you've gone on to have a pretty illustrious career in education, so clearly things worked. And to you, Abby, about a minute before our first break here, I mean, schools are often the decision or the deciding factor in where families are going to live.
Yeah.
And we know this is an issue in Philadelphia. I'm sure it's an issue in many other cities. Can you speak to that?
Sure. And the schools were really a dividing line in West Mount Airy. Many, many people felt that residential integration was possible, and they were deeply committed to residential integration. But when it came to their children, the language really shifted. And in some ways, residential integration in Mount Airy worked in spite of the sort of tendencies and structural things that were set up to create and foster separation. So the politics, the policies that were taking place around the country. In schools, you couldn't get away from those politics and policies and economics and city structures. And so Mount Airy was unique in that it was very close to a number of private institutions. And it allowed people in the community to say, I am deeply committed to residential integration. I am going to stay here. And I'm going to take myself out of the educational sphere. So
the public schools.
The public sphere, yeah. So Henry School, which was at the integrated core of West Mount Airy, a number of people started their kids there, and Henry had this amazing principal, Beatrice Chernock, who was really committed to integration there, but families started to send their kids to private school, so they didn't have to engage in that.
Well, we're going to take that short break and then get back to our conversation. We are talking about the history of West Mount Airy here in Philadelphia. That's Abigail Perkis. She's got a new book. It's called Making Good Neighbors, and joining us by telephone, Joan Canada Countryman. We want to hear from you, 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Support for WHYY comes from the new Wells Fargo Propel World American Express card, designed to bring the world within reach for Wells Fargo customers. Details at a local Philadelphia area branch or wellsfargo.com/propel. Wells Fargo, the world is open. Keep exploring.
These days, it's a 24-hour news cycle.
Information is everywhere.
But is it the right information? I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Jennifer Lynn. You rely on WHYY and NPR to start your day with not just the headlines, but the in-depth details.
Reporters at WHYY and NPR News are covering stories down the block and around the world.
It's radio so vibrant, you can almost see it.
So you're better informed and ready to take on the day.
Morning Edition, weekday mornings on WHYY.
I'm Robin Young. The great creator of New York's Central Park and Boston's Emerald Necklace, Frederick Law Olmsted, came to landscape architecture late in life.
He was part of one of the Transcendentalists. So everything Olmsted did, he did with an eye to how he could improve American society and make it more democratic.
Next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
Bad energy habits around the office can affect your bottom line. PICO, smart ideas for your business can help with customized tips, information, and programs designed to save you energy and money. Learn more at PICO.com/smart ideas. PICO supports WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. We are talking about the history of Westmount Airy here in Philadelphia. Became one of the first intentionally integrated communities in the country. That's what our guest, Abigail Perkis, writes about in her new book called Making Good Neighbors. She's a historian and assistant professor at Kane University in New Jersey. On the telephone, Joan Kennedy, countryman. She moved with her family to Mount Airy in 1951, the first African-American student to graduate from Germantown Friends, and she has gone on to have a quite illustrious career in education. Joining us now is Christy Balka, and she grew up in Mount Airy. Her parents, Jerry and Arlene, were active in the integration movement. Her father was the president of West Mount Airy Neighbors, and she now lives in East Mount Airy, works on child policy and advocacy. And Christy Balka, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thanks. Good to hear all of you.
Good to have you with us. And let me give out that phone number to our listeners, because we know a lot of our listeners live in West Mount Airy. Give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet at Marty Moss Cohen about your recollections of growing up or even living now in West Mount Airy. Christy, I was asking our other two guests some of their early recollections of growing up in West Mount Airy. What's one of yours?
Well, actually, I have really great memories of growing up in West Mount Airy, but one of my earliest memories of racial consciousness was similar to Abby's. I was a student at Henry School in first grade. My best friend, Donna Scarrett, and I decided to dress up as twins for Halloween. We were in the Henry School Halloween parade, and when we got to the stage, the teachers sitting in the first few rows broke out in hysterical laughter. And I had no idea what they were laughing about, but obviously the sight of an African-American girl and a white girl dressing up as twins was something that they found very humorous. So, you know, I would say when I started Henry School, it was very well integrated racially. My recollection is that it was about 50% white, 50% African American. Abby can correct me if I'm wrong about that. I had, you know, very strong and very deep relationships with kids from a variety of economic as well as racial backgrounds.
Well, let me go back to you, Joan, and it's interesting just to hear about people's school experiences. As we were saying, the first African-American student to graduate from Germantown Friends School, this was back in 1958. As you said, it was a bit of a risk for some people. Was that a difficult experience for you?
Well, I think it worked for me because my parents were so strong and committed and supportive of me. My younger sister also, who's only 6 years younger, so she was almost as much a pioneer as I was. Mm. For both of us, there certainly were incidents. There were situations where people challenged us or asked us questions or things that we had to deal with, but we always had our parents to turn to help support us and to respond to all kinds of things, like any situation where we might felt we were being made fun of or challenged or we didn't belong or things like that. And I would say that I also sent my children to Germantown Friends. My children are biracial, and they also certainly came to me and my parents and the adults in their community with stories of the challenges of race. One of the things I feel that we need to look at and talk about is how we talk about race. There certainly was a feeling in the 50s and 60s that we would somehow solve this problem and it would go away at some point. it certainly occurred to me that what we need to do is learn how to talk about race with our children and with each other. And certainly, I think what helped me was that my parents were always willing to talk to us about what was going on.
Sure, sure.
What skin color meant and why.
Let me pick up on that and toss it to you, Abby, even from all the interviews that you've done. I mean, by creating an integrated neighborhood where people lived, did that force people to talk race, or was it sort of assumed that people had certain political beliefs and so it didn't need to be talked about?
There's a really interesting history to that, and it shifts a lot over the course of the second half of the 20th century. In the early years of integration, I think people were really reluctant to talk about race. And so you have people talking about the mutual benefit of the community. You have people talking about like-minded individuals. You have a real conversation taking place about class and people saying, you know, we are inviting people into the community who share similar values, who share similar educational statuses, who share similar bank accounts.
Like us.
Exactly. They weren't necessarily using that exact language, but that was the implication. You know, by the early 70s, late 60s, you have people in Mount Airy confronting race in a little bit more of a direct way, and you have structured conversations taking place within different community groups about what it meant to live in an integrated community and to have black, I think, confrontations in black and white was the name of one of these conversations. And there was a moment where it seemed like people were going to continue that and to foster those conversations, and then West Mount Airy Neighbors backpedaled a little bit and said, maybe we should continue our conversation about the mutual benefits. So it was a real push-pull within the community.
And Christy, having read the chapter about you, I mean, it sounds like you grew up in a bit of a bubble. You go off to college and you realize that West Mount Airy was an unusual place to grow up and an unusual place to develop friendships.
That's right. I went to college thinking that, not having any idea that my experience was unique, and thinking everyone in my age group had grown up in a racially integrated environment, and I was very unprepared for for language that came out of the mouths of fellow college students once I left home. One of the reasons I moved back to Philadelphia 10 years later is I was living in Chicago. It was racially polarized around the time that Harold Washington was elected as the city's first black mayor. And although Washington won, there was a lot of, a lot of sort of verbal violence. I had a white neighbor whose garage was burnt down during the Washington campaign because he was campaigning for Harold Washington. And I moved back to Philadelphia thinking that it was a much more racially integrated environment, thinking the whole city was much more racially integrated than Chicago. Little did I know, but I learned from reading once I returned, that Philadelphia historically has had one of the highest rates of racial segregation, residential racial segregation of any city. But I had no idea that my experience in Mount Airy had been unique growing up.
Abby, you nodded when Christy said that this has a history of being a racially segregated city.
Yeah, I mean, Philadelphia from, in the 20th century, from the early 20th century on, just time and again, you come to find these stories of deeply politicized, deeply entrenched racism throughout the city. You have folks saying in the 1940s that Philadelphia needs to be a place where NAACP meetings are taking place or other race-based meetings because it's such a racist city. You have, Frank Rizzo in the 1970s, who is one of the most notoriously racist mayors and police commissioners of all time, I think, in the United States. But at the same time, you have people like Cecil B. Moore saying he was an equal opportunity tough guy. So it's a very complicated racial history of Philadelphia.
And Joan, can you speak to that? And then I do want to get some callers in on the conversation. From your own experience, Joan.
Yeah, I know certainly I would say that it's hard to find any place. My own children struggle with this in other places, trying to live elsewhere as much as in Philadelphia. I think
the practice of that was demonstrated in West Mount Airy shapes our perception of what's going on in Philadelphia. At the same time, if you think about the geography of Philadelphia, in fact, where did we come from? Well, our family came from North Philadelphia, came just prior to moving to Germantown from North Philadelphia, and we're just ahead of a great wave of people who, are seeking better conditions and moving in that direction. And the impact of segregation on that is still telling. It's very evident now as it has been over the last century.
And that's Joan Kennedy, countryman, who joins us along with Christy Balka and Abigail Perkis. We are talking about the history of West Mount Airy here in Philadelphia, the subject of Abby's new book called Making Good Neighbors. We have Judith, and Judith calling us from South Philadelphia. Hi, Judith. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. I'm George Shermer's daughter, Judith Shermer.
Oh,
and,
Judy.
I grew up
to hear your voice.
Well, we really appreciate the call, Judy. Go ahead.
I grew up in West Mount Airy. My father was one of the founders of the West Mount Airy Neighbors. He was the first president. And I just wanted to say that he was the head of the Human Relations Commission under Mayor Dilworth. And they actively fought against redlining. I was an adolescent, so I wasn't paying a whole lot of attention.
Right.
But I did go to Henry School for a year and a half, and then I went to Girls High. But my siblings all went to Henry, and they were younger and went to Henry in Houston. They fought against redlining, and I remember discussions about it, and I think the Human Relations Commission at the time was able to take action against redlining, legal action. But when Mayor Tate was elected, he took away the power to do that. So after that, the commission lost a lot of power. They had to wait until people made complaints, which wasn't the same as what they were doing before. Before that, I think, if I'm not mistaken, they were able to bring legal pressure against real estate companies.
Real estate agencies that were doing this.
Redline, and that was part. And my father was extremely invested in making Mount Airy, keeping Mount Airy integrated, and he had tried that where we lived in Detroit, and it failed.
Oh, that's interesting.
Because there was too much white flight, including, unfortunately, us. But we weren't fleeing for that reason. We just moved to Philadelphia because he got a job here.
Well, Judith, let me give, sounds like everyone wants to talk to you, but let me start with Abby. Go ahead.
No, it's a really interesting story that you're telling, and I think that's right around when Mayor Tate came in, that's right around when your dad resigned because he was losing that power and because he...
Protest.
And there's this outpouring of people, you know, asking him, agitating for him to stay. But what he was doing at the Human Relations Commission was really mirrored in Mount Airy, and he was able to foster that relationship between the city government and the local politics here in the neighborhood. Mm-hmm. So those lawsuits against real estate agents at the city level were happening in Mount Airy. They weren't lawsuits, but they were, people, complaints being made from West Mount Airy neighbors to the specific agents, and then there was a board of agents that came together to practice positive, race-blind real estate. And so your father was really instrumental in bringing that together. And I think
I was always proud of growing up in Mount Airy, West Mount Airy, and I came back. I lived in Chicago for a while, but when I got divorced, I came back with my two daughters and raised them in West Mount Airy. They did not go to public school, but that wasn't because of me. That was because of my mother-in-law, who...
Well, we're not going to go there, Judith. We're not going to go there. Let me give Joan a chance to weigh in. Joan, anything you want to add?
Well, I will add, first of all, Judy, I do remember you, since we were adolescents at the same time, and I do remember that your family and the work that both of your parents, but particularly your father's work. I want to also say that in my son, who's an historian, has written a book about Philadelphia. It's called Up South, and he talks about a lot about George Shermer and the work that the Commission on Human Relations did.
Yeah, Judy, thanks for calling into Radio Times. You can call as well. And again, that phone number, 1-888-477-9499. Abby, let me go back to you, because your book is about the history of West Mount Airy, but it also takes a look at some of the, I guess, the myths that have grown up about around this neighborhood. What kinds of myths?
Well, I think there's this ideal that people talk about of this integrated space, of this sort of utopian community. And in some ways, people then thought of it less as a utopian community than they do now. And that legacy of integration, the memory of integration, is almost more powerful than the integration that people were creating. They knew when they were creating it in the 50s and 60s that this was a strategy. This was a group of liberal, highly powerful people saying, this is our way of creating and maintaining our community. And we're going to do this, and we're going to see this as achieved racial justice, but that's more of a strategy than a goal. And now, and you know, from the 80s to today, people really saw that as their goal, and they've reconceived it as this idealized democracy.
How about for you, Chrissy?
Well, I was very much conditioned by the ideal and also by the, you know, the practice day to day, you know, by the reality. But I spoke to my parents this morning and asked them some questions about the process of integration in Mount Airy. And my mother told me that when the first black family moved into West Mount Airy, moved into a house on Lincoln Drive, this must have been the early 50s, she said cell signs went up on every lawn on Lincoln Drive. These were white families that, you know, were looking to move immediately. And I have to say that my reaction, I found that very jolting. It's not something that I had ever imagined, even though I'd heard the stories about it. I'd heard why adults in the community went door to door and asked whites not to sell. But somehow the image of sell signs going up on front lawns along Lincoln Drive was something I had never quite considered. So I would say I'm a product of both the myth and the reality.
Well, and yeah, Christy, go ahead, Joan.
Hi, Christy. On the other hand, am enough older than you are to remember the sale signs, and in fact, to remember that that work was what as a child was what I thought my parents were doing, was fighting that. They were they were working with real estate agents. They were trying to make sure that that was outlawed, and eventually there were, in fact, my husband and I had a discussion with him about, I said, you can put a sold sign in the house, but do not put a sale sign on the house, and that comes from that experience that, people, you know, immediately were signaling that they were going to flee because it's what my father used to call the black plague.
Wow, in quotations.
Were coming.
Well, you know what, Joan, and we have to take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation again. That's Joan Kennedy Countryman, also with us, Abigail Perkis and Christy Balka. We are talking about the history of West Mount Airy here in Philadelphia, one of the first intentionally integrated communities in the country. We've got a bunch of people that want to call us at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet at Marty Moss Cohen. We'll be right back.
Philadelphia Fight supports WHYY and presents the 20th annual AIDS Education Month. Events, conferences, and workshops throughout June to increase HIV awareness and find strategies to end the AIDS epidemic. Featuring Nobel Prize winner Françoise Barré-Sinoussi, noted author and civil rights advocate Michelle Alexander, Reverend Jeremiah Wright, and Grammy nominee Wale in a concert on National HIV Testing Day. All events are open to the public. More at AIDSEducationMonth.org.
If I do my job perfectly, I will probably kill you.
On the next Fresh Air, Shep Gordon talks about his life as a Hollywood insider. After a chance encounter with Janis Joplin and Jimi Hendrix, he became the manager for Alice Cooper, Blondie, and Pink Floyd. He's influenced countless stars and is the subject of a new documentary by Mike Myers, who also joins us.
this afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
Too many times in the last few years, we've heard this similar story of tragic, unnecessary violence. But is there anything we can do to predict or change this violent behavior, or should we just give up and focus more on minimizing its deadly expression through controlling access to weapons? I'm Dan Gottlieb, and on the next Voices in the Family, random mass shootings and what we can do to prevent them. Today at noon, here on WHYY FM.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Mosco, and just to recap, we are talking about the history of West Mount Airy here in Philadelphia, the subject of Abigail Perkis's new book called Making Good Neighbors. It's about her growing up in West Mount Airy, returning as a young adult, also that neighborhood's evolution, unusual because a group of residents in the 1950s and 60s were determined to make it an integrated neighborhood, which they did. It took a lot of work, and we've been talking about all of this with Abigail Perkis, Joan Kennedy Countryman, who grew up there as well, and Christy Balka, who grew up in West Mount Airy. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Abby, we were talking during the break, this whole effort of keeping this, or having West Mount Airy stay this integrated neighborhood required knocking on people's doors, the principal at Henry School calling people. Help us understand the sort of very personal campaign that was afoot.
Yeah, this wasn't an organic process. This was very intentional and took place from the home to, over the fence to the grocery store to church meetings to schools. And you had people at every step coaxing and prodding and saying, we need you to become involved. And so Beatrice Chernock, who I mentioned earlier, was this amazing advocate and this amazing strategist. And she also, she would call white families and say, come on in. And then she would give them directed tours of the school and really highlight particular things that would be, positive for white parents. And there are plenty of stories of her doing those things at the expense of the black students at the school.
Oh, not doing the same thing for the black students?
Yeah, and really alienating and marginalizing some of the black families at the school.
Part of the complicated history here. Let me get, looks like Mark from Ambler to join our conversation. Hi, Mark. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, Marty. Thank you.
You're welcome.
I went from kindergarten to fifth grade at Henry School in the early 50s, along with Wendy Shermer. And I didn't know at that age about any of these things that were going on. I was just a kid. Who knew? But I knew that I was a mixture of kids in my school. And I was on Westry Street, just down the street from Summit Church. But I did notice after I grew up and went away and looked back that in the years where I was growing up, we all called that Germantown where we grew up. Germantown Junior Center, of course, which I belonged to, was named after the neighborhood. And it wasn't until years later that it became West Mount Airy, and I could only guess that that area wanted to have a different identity than Lower Germantown, and so it sort of that name sort of morphed into place. And on our block, there was a house sold that my parents used the term block breaking. That a realtor came in and purposely sold a house so that they could then expecting the white flight, and that they could then generate sales of other houses. But it ultimately did not work out. The neighborhood stayed stable and progressed more naturally.
Yeah, Mark, I appreciate
that. I don't know why it changed names.
Let's see if we can find out. Let me toss that first to you, Abby.
Yeah, I think this is a really important point. The way we define neighborhood boundaries and identities really helps to construct the way politics works. So West Mount Airy became defined by West Mount Airy neighbors. I mean, they created these very strict boundaries for the neighborhood. In the 1960s, when East Mount Airy neighbors was developed, they created a set of boundaries for East Mount Airy. I've been told anecdotally that SEPTA actually created the division between East and West Mount Airy, but I'm not sure if that's true. My parents grew up in West Oak Lane, which is east of East Mount Airy. They called the neighborhood Mount Airy, but Mount Airy disavowed itself of West Oak Lane. And I think in a lot of ways, West Oak Lane became the victim of not having a political voice. And so it was a neighborhood that transitioned, over the course of 3 years from all white to all black. And I think the fact that East Mount Airy and West Mount Airy defined themselves by such strict geographic boundaries allowed for this political advocacy to take place and for communities around it to be affected.
Joan, I'd be curious about your thoughts.
Well, when I first was there, we called everything Germantown, including the part I now will say was in West Mount Airy that I lived in. In fact, Germantown, in my mind, referred to everything of part of Northwest Philadelphia, including Chestnut Hill. It was far away. It was hard to get to unless you had a car, and not everyone had a car, and certainly in the 50s. But those boundaries became increasingly important as the 60s unfolded, and certainly the civil rights movement had an impact on what, first of all, on people's aspirations, and then also where they wanted to tell you they lived.
Well, Christy, you live now in East Mount Airy. I mean, and you grew up in West Mount Airy. Do you see two different cultures?
I don't see two different cultures. There were definitely two different cultures when I was growing up. What I remember is that East Mount Airy changed from predominantly white to predominantly African American in a very short period of time in the early to mid 60s, while West Mount Airy was more stable. I have been told by people who grew up in East Mount Airy that the distinction between the two neighborhoods was created by real estate agents and created by West Mount Airy real estate agents who did not want property values to fall during that period. So, you know, what I was told is that up until that time, it was all Mount Airy. I will say something about Germantown, and that is my generation is probably the last generation that recalls being much more connected to Germantown for a variety of things, from, you know, running to the supermarket or the grocery store or to a department store, you know, going to Germantown as opposed to going to Chestnut Hill or the suburbs. And this has a lot to do with the development of the suburbs and the, you know, sort of the suburbanization of our city and disinvestment from urban neighborhoods like Germantown.
Let me get Rhoda from Chestnut Hill to join us. Rhoda, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yeah. I wonder if the speakers could discuss the role of Twin Realty, the two women, Shirley Melvin and Doris Polsky, who made a great effort to keep West Mount Airy integrated. I lived in West Mount Airy for a while. I taught at Henry School, and I think that their role was very central in this effort.
They were mainstays of West Mount Airy Neighbors. That I remember. They were in our kitchen and living room, and my parents were in their house all the time. They were staunch supporters of racial integration and sort of all things in the neighborhood in general. I mean, they were really one of the nerve centers of progressive change in the neighborhood.
Go ahead, Abby.
Yeah, they were. They were involved in the creation of the Allen's Lane Art Center, which was started as a way to create a secular space away from these religious institutions to foster integration. And I believe it was in 1963 that they created Twin Realty. They were one of the first, if not the first, solely women-owned real estate companies. And they created the company specifically to foster integrated space. I had the privilege of speaking to Shirley several years ago. She was actually the very first interview I did for this project when I was in graduate school, and she has since passed away. And the stories that she told and the level of reflection and insight, she just has such a memory. She had such a memory of the community, and she was so, so actively involved.
Joan, what's so interesting about this story is that you've got institutions, religious and secular, and then you have individuals who are absolutely just determined to create, make this integrated community. And I wonder if there are lessons for other communities across the country. Joan?
Well, the immediate lesson from this conversation is how important the real estate agents can be, and how certainly the work of the founders of Twin Realty, for example, that's what my parents were aspiring for. They were hoping, because they knew perfectly well what most realtors were doing. And we certainly have experienced that well past the 60s, that deliberate attempt to undermine what was happening in terms of social justice.
Mm-hmm. Rhoda, thanks for the call to Radio Times. We have Susan. Susan calling us from West Mount Airy. And go ahead, you're on Radio Times.
Hi.
Hi there.
I'm a proud resident, longtime resident of West Mount Airy. And I just wanted to hear from your guests their response to another issue and another wave of problem for West Mount Airy, which is I feel very strongly about living here and our integrated neighborhood and interfaith neighborhood. But Philadelphia, the city of Philadelphia, has pushed institutions onto West Mount Airy. We are four times impacted over other areas of Philadelphia, so that anytime somebody moves out, and I understand these are big homes,
right?
That an institution tries to get moved in, and we are, what I'd love to see is how swift our area is in coming together, and this is absolutely a integrated interfaith movement to stop really what would be a destruction of a neighborhood. And unfortunately, the last wave of this, when we tried to stop, and we did successfully, it was the comments that we would hear and things that we would see published was, it's the white rich families that don't want a boarding home or rehab center. But in fact, we have done this four times over any other part of the city.
And well, you know what, Susan? Let me take your mm-hmm. comments and actually give our guests a chance mm-hmm. to respond. Abby, you want to weigh in on that at all?
Yeah, it's a really complicated question. You see this taking place, as you said, there's been a number of waves of this. The one that I'm most familiar with is in the 1980s when we had the construction of a home for AIDS patients in West Mount Airy, and also a home for troubled youth. And there was a big movement within the community to stop the construction of both of these places. And I think what this is reflective of is that Mount Airy is not immune to the effects of urbanization, effects of deindustrialization. And it's a community where people are struggling with how to respond to that. They in some ways are built on this. The community is built on this idea of tolerance and liberal, you know, pluralism. And at the same time, people are really protective of the neighborhood and they want to maintain it in a bit of a bubble, for lack of a better word. So there's a real push-pull of how to negotiate that. And as you say,
tricky stuff.
Yeah, it's tricky and people in the city have responses to it.
Chrissy, I'd be curious about your response.
Yeah, I mean, what doesn't get talked about in the mythologizing of West Mount Airy, what doesn't get talked about is the economic homogeneity. Compared to the rest of the city, we are a fairly homogeneous group, and I don't know that we have the same share of public housing, for example, that other communities have, or the same share of Section 8 housing. I think that for a long time, communities in Northwest Philadelphia, not just Mount Airy, have created housing for people with intellectual disabilities, for seniors living on fixed incomes, almost as an alternative to accepting traditional public housing and Section 8 residents. So I think it is double-edged. I remember a very ugly fight that Abby's referring to over a facility for AIDS patients in Upper West Mount Airy. And I think this needs to be examined from all sides. It's I think it really is double-edged. I don't think there's one side on this one.
You want to add to that, Abby?
Just a real quick statement. Christy's comment about the economics being a big part of this, I mean, that's the foundation of why integration in Mount Airy work. There's a number of things that make Mount Airy unique, and I don't think we have time to get to all of them, but the economic exclusivity that this integration, that this racial integration was predicated upon is so intrinsic to the integration project from the 1950s to today, and it can't be overlooked.
I'm going to squeeze Janice on. Janice from Mount Airy joining us on Radio Times. Janice, you have about 30 seconds. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Well, yes, I had two observations. I live across the street from Henry School in Mount Airy, and my observation is that it's really as segregated as anything that we may have seen during Jim Crow. And then secondly, I think we need to update our view of the suburbs, which actually are really, I think, on kind of the front lines of diversity right now. And I'm wondering if our speakers have, you know, looked at either of those right. issues.
Janice, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Joan, I'm going to toss that over to you and even add the word diversity. I mean, we've been talking about integration in terms of black and white, but we are even a much more diverse country today than we were back in the 1950s.
We certainly are, and we have, I think the caller is exactly right, that we have an opportunity at least to broaden the definition of what we mean by a diverse community, and to find ways to be more welcoming of all groups. On the other hand, that's not going to solve the problems of our cities and what we have in cities will remain challenged until we figure out how to help them grow in a way that supports their staying strong and not being torn apart by these conflicts.
Well, we could go on. We have to end our conversation. Joan Kennedy, Countryman, thank you so much for joining us today in Radio Times.
My pleasure.
And Christy Balka, thank you very much as well.
You're welcome.
And Abigail Perkis, thank you for joining us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. And her book is called Making Good Neighbors, Civil Rights, Liberalism, and Integration in Post-War Philadelphia. And we appreciate all those phone calls to Radio Times as well, some memories of West Mount Airy. Go to WHYY.org/Radio Times. You can download podcasts of the show. You can follow us on Twitter and Facebook. And you can sign up for the weekly newsletter. That's WHYY.org/Radio Times. We welcome Ariel Plotnick, our new intern, Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Susan Greenbaum, Debbie Builder, Emily Bryant, with help this week from Sophie Reed. I'm Marty Moscowane. Thank you so much for joining us.